break from sobriety at the moment. Moncrain's in the Weeping Tower, said Alondo.
What's that? Said Jean.
The most secure prison in Espara. It's Countess Dragoon's on the doors, not City Watch.
Oh, hell's blistered balls, said Locke. He already got taken up for debt?
Debt? Said Janora. No, he never got the chance to be hauled in for all that mess. He decked some pissant lordling across the jaw this morning. He's up for assaulting someone of noble blood.
Chapter 6. The Five-Year Game. Change of Venue. 1.
Fourth son Vidalos, said Jostin. Would that your parents had stopped at their third. How many nights have you spent leaning against my bar, eh? How many times have I brought you in out of the rain for a glass? You two-faced son of a—
For the gods' sakes, said Vidalos, do you think I want this? It's my duty.
In front of half the council and the entire Deep Roots.
Jostin, said Locke, stepping between the innkeeper and Vidalos, let's talk. Harold, how do you do? I'm Lazare, an advisor.
Whose advisor?
Everyone's advisor. I'm a solicitor from La Chaine, retained in a broad capacity. I require a moment in private with Master Jostin to discuss his options.
I don't see that he has any, said Vidalos.
Do you have orders to refuse us a few minutes for reflection? Said Locke.
Of course not.
Then I'll thank you not to enforce orders you haven't been given. Locke put an arm firmly around Jostin's shoulders, turned the sputtering innkeeper away from the herald, and whispered,
Jostin, one thing. Are you absolutely certain your license is truly paid up?
I have a signed receipt in my papers. I could fetch it now and shove it up this powder-blue pimp's ass. Until tonight, I would have called the bastard a good friend, on my honour. I never would have thought.
Don't think, said Locke. I'm paid to do that for you. Harold Vidalos isn't your enemy. It's whoever summoned him to work and gave him a warrant that somehow urgently needed to be served at 10:30 hour of the evening. Do you follow?
Ah, said Jostin. Ah.
We shouldn't abuse the poor bastard whose boots are on the pavement, said Locke. Our troubles come from higher offices. Nicoras, get over here. Look at this seal and signature.
Capability paralysis, said Nicoras.
Sweat ran down his forehead in glistening lines.
Second clerk, magistrate's court. I've heard of her.
She wouldn't need an actual magistrate to sign this, said Locke.
No, said Nicoras. Magistrates only sign off on, arrests.
And this, said Locke, is just a little sting in the ass. Is she Black Iris, or any of her superiors?
Not according to my lists, said Nicoras. Most of the people at the court make a point of not declaring for either party.
Well, someone got her to perform a favour. Locke suddenly became aware that most of the party, rank on tipsy rank, were watching closely to see if their mountain of fine liquor was really to be severed from them on the word of a single nervous functionary. I don't suppose Conseil members can just order Vidalos to make himself scarce.
Magistrates are, co-equal with the Conseil, said Nicoras. Their heralds don't have to take orders from anyone else.
Well, our drunk friends are going to hang this poor bastard from the rafters if I let this go through. Locke turned back to Herald Vidalos, grinning broadly. Everything seems to be perfectly in order.
It gives me little satisfaction, said Vidalos.
I'd have thought you'd be happy, said Locke, since there's absolutely no need for you to shut down the party.
Having delivered the warrant, said Vidalos, it pains me to report that I'm bound to carry out my directions therein. I have to observe that Master Jostin has ended this affair and sealed his doors to new customers.
Begging your pardon, but you're not allowed to do anything of the sort, said Locke. That's premature restraint of trade, which is forbidden under the Articles of Carthane. Whoever signed this warrant should have known that Jostin is entitled by law to verification of these charges before a magistrate.
But
prior to interruption of commerce, continued Locke. Look, this is fairly basic stuff from that amendment business about, 20 years ago.
I... Really?
Vidalos' face lost some of its plum colour.
Are you quite sure? I'm not entirely familiar with that, and I have served a number of similar... I'm fully bonded for practice in Carthane. Imposition of penalty without proper verification of these charges would expose you to censure for negligence, the penalties for which could be... Well, of course, you know what they could be. Let's not dwell on them. Said Vidalos. Of course. So, you've served your warrant in front of the most credible body of witnesses the city could hope to produce. I accept the warrant on Justin's behalf and formally request a magistrate's verification of its charges. Since we can't possibly have that until at least tomorrow morning, the party must continue.
Ha! That served you out! Shouted someone within the crowd. Shuffle off, tipstaff!
None of that! Yelled Locke. For shame! This man is a good friend to this house, given the awful task of serving this warrant against his will. And did he flinch? No. Obedient to duty, he stepped into the lion's den.
Hear him!
Cried first son Epitalus. Whether he realized the stupidity of needlessly making an enemy of Vidalos, or merely wished his own voice to ring loudest in any acclamation, Locke blessed him.
Carthage should be proud to have such an honest and fearless fellow in its service.
People immediately followed Epitalus' lead. Catcalls that had barely started up were replaced with a rising swell of applause.
I regret my harsh words, said Diligence Justin, propelled toward Vidalos by a subtle elbow from Locke, and fully taking the hint. Give me your pardon, and have a glass with us.
Oh, but... Vidalos seemed pleased, relieved, and embarrassed all at once. I'm on duty.
Surely not, said Justin. The warrant is served, so your duties are finished.
Well, if you put it that way... Justin and several accomplices enfolded the herald into the crowd and shuffled him toward the liquor supply.
Oh, thank the gods, muttered Nicoros. I had no idea you'd picked up such a knowledge of Carthani law, Lazari.
I haven't, said Locke. When the sky's falling, I take shelter under bullshit. Someone's going to figure that out soon enough tomorrow.
Then there's no such statute?
Fake as a man with three cocks.
Really? Damn, it sounded so reasonable. Lying to an officer of the court is an offense they could...
That's not worth worrying about. If pressed, I'll use the never-fail universal apology.
What's the never-fail universal apology?
I was badly misinformed. I deeply regret the error. Go fuck yourself with this bag of money. But it shouldn't come to that. First thing tomorrow, we need to reach this capability paralysis. If Justin's papers are magically found to have been misplaced, then the whole affair dries up before it can call further attention to itself.
And if she won't roll over for us, said Jean, who'd been hovering nearby.
We get someone else. First clerk, maybe, or an actual magistrate. We're buying ourselves a little corner of the magistrate's court tomorrow, come hell or Eldrin fire. When do the courts open?
9th hour of the morning.
Be outside our door at 8.
At 8, said Locke, reducing his voice to a cold whisper. So don't stuff any more of that shit down your throat tonight. I don't have any idea what you...
Yes, you do. I don't care if you're totally out of your head on a cadris. I'll put a damn leash around your neck and drag you by it. We're all going together to put this fire out before it spreads.
2.
Nicoros,
muttered Locke, bleary-eyed and fog-brained as he swung the apartment door open in response to a frenzied pounding.
What the hell are you about, man? It can't be anywhere near 8 yet.
It's just after 5.
Nicoros looked as though he'd been boot-stomped by a gang of hangover fairies. His hair was undone, his clothes haphazard, and the bags under his eyes could have been used for coin pouches.
They've got my office, Lazari, just like you said.
What?
Locke blinked the glue from his eyes and ushered Nicoros inside.
Someone burned your office down?
No, it's not arson.
Nicoros nodded to Jean, who'd come in through the connecting door from his side of the suite. Jean wore a black silk dressing gown and was carrying his hatchets casually in his right hand.
The Master Ratfinder's office cordoned off my whole bloody building for a suckle spider infestation. Sheer luck I wasn't there when they showed up. Otherwise I'd be getting an alchemical bath in quarantine.
Your scribe?
He dodged them too. Almost everything was copied or removed in time. But now they'll be fumigating with brimstone for 3 days. Can't use the place until they're done.
I don't suppose you'd ever seen so much as one hair on a suckle spider's ass.
The building's 2 years old, clean as an infant's soul.
Another how do you do from our friends across town. How many people work for this rat finder?
12 or so. Alchemists, sewer stalkers, corpse hunters. They handle all things pestilent and sanitary.
How are they regarded?
Master Bilezzo's a hero. Hell, I mostly think so, too. Keeps the city damned clean compared to a lot of other places. 40 years without a plague in Carthay, not even cholera. People notice that sort of thing.
This is touchy, then, said Jean. We can't be heavy-handed dealing with this, or it'll snap right back at us. Sap, someone in the opposition keeps choosing delicate instruments to poke us with.
We need some delicate instruments of our own, said Locke. We're not going to have any time to deal with the election if we have to run around pissing on these distractions.
Do you think you can get my office back?
Locke scratched his stubble. No. Look, Nikoros, no offense, but if we've got you and your files, we don't need your office. Let them smoke it out. Our job as far as this Master Bilezzo is concerned is to make sure Justin's isn't closed down for similar treatment.
Very well, said Nikoros. But my rooms, I suppose I'll have to board here for a few days.
That might not be a bad thing. This place is our castle, and the siege has started. Speaking of which, after we deal with the magistrate's court, get me some actual solicitors, trustworthy sorts. I presume the party has a few.
Of course.
Have them join the menagerie here, in the best suites Justin has left. Next time someone walks in with writs or warrants or God knows what, I want real paper pushers on hand to spin authentic nonsense.
We seem to be off to a bad start, said Nikoros.
We are.
And I must apologize for my, you know, it's just an occasional thing, you understand. Keeps me working through the long nights. I can stop if you
do. Throw that shit away. We need you steady and reliable. Dustheads are neither.
I'm not a dusthead.
Save it. I've seen more dustheads, gazers, pissers, burners, and stone lickers than you can imagine. I've even crawled into a bottle myself once or twice. Don't try to placate me. Just do us all a favor and stay off it. Get pickled on booze like an ordinary deep roots man.
I can, as you say, I can do it.
And don't sweat our situation. By tonight, we'll be walled in with brutes and solicitors. Most of the locks will be changed. Justin will secure his staff. You'll feel better once our basic defenses are in place. Now get a room. Get what sleep you can. Master Callus and I will fetch you at 8. And hey, tell whoever's on duty we want enough coffee to kill a horse. When the coffee came a few minutes later, the maid delivering it wore a gleaming brass chain around her neck.
That was quick work on Justin's part, said Jean, pouring 2 steaming cups. The chains, I mean. You don't believe it'll keep out real mischief, though? Wouldn't stop either of us, I should think.
It's not meant to, said Locke. It's a simple obstacle for the witless and unlucky. The less time we have to waste on idiots, the more we can devote to everything else Sabatha does. 3. It was a cool, mist-haunted morning. Water trickled down every window, and the pavements were slick. A few minutes before 8, Locke and Jean hustled Nikoros, who looked as though sleep had been scarce, into a carriage. Locke gnawed indelicately at half a loaf of bread stuffed with cold meat from the party. This breakfast was disposed of by the time they made their first stop of the morning at Tivoli's to reinforce the coins in their purses with a few hundred comrades. Next they rattled north to the Casta Gravina, the old citadel of Carthane, whose interior walls and gates had been knocked down years before to make more room for a government that didn't have to fear anything so mundane as a hostile army at its doorstep. The plazas and gardens were so beautifully laid out that the fog might have been just one more decoration, artfully conjured and shaped by crews of overambitious groundskeepers.
"Magistrate's Court," said Nikoros, leading the way out of the carriage.
I know the place. If you want to make any money in my business, you'll end up party or witness in your share of lawsuits.
Locke and Jean followed him across a circular plaza, into the clammy silver mist that opened a few paces ahead of them and swallowed their carriage an equal distance behind. The fog echoed faintly with the sounds of the city coming to life, doors opening, horses and wheels clattering, people shouting to one another.
"Clark's office is just over here," said Nikoros.
"Oof!" A woman came out of the fog to Locke's left before he could react. She collided with Locke, steadied herself against him, and was then snatched away rather ignominiously by Jean.
"Gods above!" she cried.
The voice was creaky, middle-aged, Carthani.
"It's fine, Master Callus, it's fine," said Locke.
He patted his purse and papers, verifying their undisturbed state. The collision might or might not be innocent, but the woman seemed to be no pickpocket.
"A thousand apologies. You startled us, madam," said Jean, releasing the woman.
She was a few inches shorter than Locke, broad and heavy, dressed in a dull but expensive fashion. Her grey-dusted brown hair was pinned up under an elegant four-cornered cap, and her face was lined with whatever cares had chased her through life. Locke prayed silently that they hadn't just upset one of the very clerks they might want to suborn.
"It's you who startled me, looming out of the fog like a pack of highwaymen."
"I wouldn't call it looming, madam. Some of us simply aren't built for looming," said Locke.
"You, perhaps not, but I could plant your big friend in the street to shade the roof of my house."
She readjusted her coat with a sharp tug and went on her way, scowling.
"Good day, oafs."
"Nikoros," said Jean.
"Was that anyone important?"
"Never seen her before."
"Well, let's get inside before we trip over someone we can't afford to offend," said Locke.
The office of the clerks wasn't particularly large, but it was comfortably appointed. The purgatory of quiet halls and empty chairs outside the clerical chambers looked like a decent place to fall asleep in. Capability Paralis, a round and attractive woman on the kinder side of 40, was scratching away at papers behind her desk when Locke, Jean, and Nikoros entered her chamber.
"I'm sorry," she said,
irritably tossing thick, dark ringlets out of her eyes as she looked up.
"No appointments before 10:30. Where's the hall secretary?"
"The secretary has been taken advantage of by my excessive natural and financial charms," said Locke, who'd been charming to the tune of a month's salary. "I'm sure you can sympathize."
Locke settled smoothly into one of the chairs before Paralis' desk, and Jean casually drew the door shut. Nikoros stood off to one side and pretended to admire the walls.
"I've no idea who you think you are, sir."
"Last night," said Locke, "a warrant was signed and sent out from this office, a warrant concerning Justin's comprehensive accommodations. If you're Justin's counsel, you know bloody well when the public proceedings are held."
"What I know," said Locke, "is that some miracle caused the records for the payment of Justin's Ardent Spirits license, which is perfectly sound, to be misplaced. I'd like that miracle reversed. I do understand that miracles are expensive."
Sighing inwardly at the artlessness of this approach, there was no time to waste on subtlety, Locke swept a hand across the desktop, leaving a comet-like trail of gold coins.
"Is that meant to impress me?" said Paralis, softly, fiercely.
Oh, her version of offended, honest public functionary deserved applause.
"Attempted bribery of a civic official. You'll shed your boldness when you're chained to an interrogation cell wall."
"Good God, that's lovely," said Locke. "I'm really sorry that I simply don't have time to play this game with you. That's your annual salary right there on the desktop. I propose to give you 6 more payments just like it, 1 per week until this election is over. All I ask is that no further complications to Deep Roots Party business be specially conjured by you or your staff. Nothing more."
"Well," she said, dropping her facade of outrage, "what if another benefactor is willing to provide additional funds in a contrary direction?"
"Notify us," said Locke. "We'll match anything you're offered. I don't even want you to take action against that other benefactor. Merely refrain from taking action against us. Make up excuses. Imply that you're under scrutiny, that further accommodations are temporarily impossible. Surely you can see it's a sweet arrangement where you're concerned."
"It's not without its temptations," she mused.
Quit being coy. Just say yes and earn a fortune. Well, then, yes. I have your word this warrant concerning Justin is a misunderstanding, and the record in question is going to be found, by the happiest happenstance, as soon as I leave this office?
You may safely consider the matter settled.
Good. If it remains settled next week, I'll call again with more decorations for your desk. Now, if you'll excuse us, we have a tight schedule of pushing boulders up hills.
You know,
said Nikoros quietly as they left the second clerk's office,
not to criticize, but if no particular tact is required in these matters, I've 100 deep roots men and women who can make these calls in their official capacities.
No, said Locke. When it comes to just laying out money, leave our official friends out of it. Save them for areas in which their authority is needed. There's no point in blunting our tools in the wrong applications.
Well, said Nikoros, you're damned impossible to argue with, Master Lazari.
Not impossible, said Jean placidly. About as intractable as a tortoise with its arse on fire, though.
If we're going to catch up to the opposition, said Locke, we've got to step boldly at every...
There he is! There's the man who stole my purse!
Cried a familiar voice as Locke emerged once again onto the fog-shrouded plaza. The middle-aged woman stood there, flanked by two men in pale blue coats reminiscent of the one worn by Vidalos. These men wore studded leather vests beneath them, however, and had clubs hanging from their belts.
Gods, so it hadn't been an innocent collision after all.
Your pardon, sir, said one of the guards, stepping forward, but I must ask to see your pockets.
A black silk purse, said the woman, with the initials GB in red in one of the corners. 7 ducats in it, or at least there were.
Locke patted himself down hurriedly. Yes, there was a slender new weight in the lower left inside pocket of his rather excellent new coat. He hadn't noticed the addition. He'd been so satisfied with verifying that nothing had been removed. Stupid, clumsy, amateurish.
I say, he sputtered, this is an intolerable accusation. How dare you, madam, how dare you? And how dare you, sir, suggest that a gentleman might be turned upside down and shaken like a common cut-purse?
Be reasonable, sir, said the guard. The lady has a precise description of what was taken, and surely proving that you don't have it is worth a moment of your time.
It is a liberty beyond comprehension. This is Carthay, not the lawless wilds.
Into his furious gesticulations, Locke worked a number of quick hand signals for Jean's benefit.
I take
Locke spasmed and sputtered. His eyes rolled back in his head, and he stumbled forward, moaning, clutching at the approaching guard. Alarmed, the man reached for his club. While Nikoros watched in mute bewilderment, Jean sprang between Locke and the guard.
"For pity's sake," Jean hissed. "Don't pull that cudgel, he's having a fit!"
said Locke, spraying flecks of spittle and waving his head about furiously.
"He's cursed!"
said the other guard, making a gesture against evil with both of his hands.
"He's got a spirit influence on him!"
"He's not cursed, you damned simpleton. It's an illness," said Jean. "Whenever his emotions run high, there's a chance he'll have a fit, and I dare say you, madam, have brought him to this state."
In a manner that seemed perfectly accidental and natural, Jean's interference was nothing less than expert, Locke broke away from Jean and the guard. Lurching like a marionette whose puppeteer was dying of some convulsive poison, he tumbled sobbing against the woman, who shrieked and pushed him away. Locke wound up on his back with Jean crouching protectively over him as he babbled, twitched, and kicked at the air.
"Stand back," said Jean. "Give him some air. The fit will pass. In a moment he'll be calm."
Locke, taking the hint, gradually reduced the severity of his symptoms until he was only gently shuddering and mumbling.
"If you really must render such low treatment to a gentleman," said Jean, "I suggest you examine his pockets now while he's not entirely himself."
The guard Locke had initially stumbled against knelt down beside him and carefully, as though Locke might leap back up at any moment, went through Locke's coat.
"Private papers and a purse not matching your description," he said, standing up. "Madam, I'm afraid it's just not there."
"He must have discarded it inside," she cried. "Search the building!"
"Now this is beyond all propriety," said Jean. My friend is a gentleman and a solicitor, and you insult him with these ridiculous accusations.
He's a pickpocket, said the woman. He ran into me to steal my purse.
This man is a convulsive, Jean bellowed. He has fits half a dozen times a day. What the hell kind of pickpocket do you think he'd make? Twitching and trembling and falling over? Gods!
Madam, said the guard, standing over Locke, he doesn't have your purse, and you must admit a gentleman with, twitching fever hardly seems a likely cut purse.
Check his friend, she said. Check the big one.
I'll gladly hand my coat over, said Jean, slowly and coldly, pretending to come to a realization. Yet I must insist that you do the same, madam.
Me?
Yes, said Jean. I understand what's going on now. I marvel that I didn't grasp it before. There is a pickpocket at work, sirs, but one wearing a lady's dress rather than a gentleman's breeches.
You foreign slime! Shouted the woman.
Constables, no doubt you've been in the company of this woman since she approached you with her complaint. I'd check if I were you to make sure of your own purses.
The guards patted themselves down, and the one standing over Locke gasped.
My coin bag, he said. It was right here in my belt.
You may examine me at length, said Jean,
extending his arms with his empty palms up.
But I must insist that your more fruitful course of action would be to examine my accuser.
The guard nearest the woman put a hand on her shoulder, mumbled apologies, and gingerly sifted her coat pockets while she screeched and struggled. After a moment, he held up a small leather coin bag and a black silk purse.
"Stitched with the initials G.B.," he said.
"But it was missing!" she cried. "It was nowhere to be found!"
"What about my coin bag, eh?" The first guard snatched the leather purse from his partner and shook it at her.
"What's this doing in your pocket?"
"I'm bloody confused," muttered the other guard. "You're meant to be," said Jean. "Forgive me for saying so. I've seen this act before. Our harmless-looking friend here has been plucking purses. Clearly she meant to frame my friend for her deeds, even while plying her trade on you, sirs. Thus, when you and any other victims discovered your light pockets, you'd have a culprit already in hand, ready to soak up all the blame. I can only imagine she tried and failed to plant her purse on my friend. Perhaps age is catching up with you, madam."
"Lying bastard!"
she shouted, trying and failing to fight off the firm grip of a guard.
"Lying, thieving, pocket-picking foreigner!"
"Right, you," said the first guard, taking her other arm. "I don't like being taken advantage of. Gentlemen, would you like to come inside with us and register your complaint as well?"
"Actually," said Jean, "I'd like to get my friend home, if not to a physica. I dare say this woman's in enough trouble for having lifted your purse. I can be content with that."
"And if you should need anything else from us," said Nikoros,
handing one of the guards a small white card, "I'm Nikoros Vialupa, Issa Salviero. These men are my guests."
"Very good, sir," said the first guard, pocketing Nikoros' card. "Sorry for that trouble. I hope the gentleman recovers." "Time and fresh lake air," said Jean, swinging Locke up and supporting him under his right arm.
"Time's the one thing he doesn't have,"
yelled the woman as the guards dragged her toward the court offices.
"And you two know it! You know it! Be seeing you, gentlemen!"
Once all three men were safely ensconced in their carriage and it was clattering away down the street, Locke returned to life and burst out laughing.
"Thank you, Nikoros," he said, wiping flecks of spittle from his chin. "That last note of respectability at the end was just what the scene needed to bring everything back down to earth."
"I bloody well rejoice to hear it," said Nikoros. "But what the hell just happened?"
"That woman slipped a purse into my coat when she stumbled into me. Obviously she meant to get me snared for pickpocketing," said Locke. "I checked to see if anything was missing, but like a dolt I didn't think to feel around for unexpected gifts. She nearly had me."
"Who was she?"
"No idea," said Locke. "She works for our counterpart, obviously, and she's a jewel. Anyone who can live to that age charming coats for a living knows their business. We'll see her again. She'll be in a cold, dark cell. Oh, she'll slip those idiots in about 5 minutes, said Jean. There'll be arrangements, trust us. I'm ashamed to admit that I actually thought for a moment that you, were genuinely ill, Lazari, said Nikoros.
We didn't have any time to warn you. Pitching a fit's a crude bit of theater, but it's surprising how often it works.
How did you guess she'd lifted that guard's purse?
I didn't guess, said Locke with an indulgent chuckle. I borrowed it when I stumbled against him.
Then he passed it on to our lady friend, along with her own purse, when he stumbled against her, said Jean.
Gods above, said Nikoros.
And don't think she didn't realize it, added Jean. But there's only so many ways you can arrange to bump tits with strangers before it starts to look fishy.
Ain't we clever, said Locke, idly examining his own pockets again. And I'm pretty sure I still have everything.
Holy hells!
There was a folded piece of parchment sealed with wax in his left inner pocket. He drew it out and stared at it.
This wasn't in my pocket when I came out the door, he said. She stuck me with it while I was slipping her the two purses.
Jean gave a low whistle as Locke popped the seal and flipped the parchment open in haste. He read the contents aloud.
Messrs. Lazari and Callus. Sirs, I trust you will excuse the unorthodox means by which this letter finds its way into your hands. Carthani postmasters, enterprising as they are, rarely deliver directly to the interior pocket of a gentleman's coat. I present my compliments and desire that you should call upon me at the 7th hour of this evening at the sign of the Black Iris in the Vel Vespala. Your most affectionate servant,
Verena Galante,
said Locke in a harsh whisper. His heart seemed to expand and fill his entire chest with its beating.
She wants to see. Oh, God.
He looked out the window, craning his neck furiously to see behind them, into the swirling silvery fog, where of course there was nothing meaningful to be found.
"What is it?" said Nikoros.
"That was no middle-aged stranger," said Locke.
"That was her."
"Who?"
"The opposition," said Locke, settling back into his seat, feeling dazed.
"Our counterpart, the woman we spoke of.
Verena Galante?"
It seems that's her present alias.
Oh, my, said Jean. The initials on the silk purse. Now that was cheeky.
Only if we weren't too dense to notice it right away, said Locke.
I fail to see how Verena Galante yields GB, said Nikoros.
A private matter, said Locke. We have a history with this woman.
What must we do now? Said Nikoros.
Now, said Locke, you can direct our driver to wherever this master ratfinder keeps his office, and after we've persuaded him to quit being a nuisance, you and Master Callus can go scrounge up the brutes we discussed yesterday.
And what about you?
Well, said Locke, running one hand over his stubble, I'll need to go find a barber. 4. Their unannounced appointment with Master Ratfinder Bilezzo took less time than their protracted encounter at the court offices. After the initial exchange of greetings and the sudden appearance of a pile of ducats on Bilezzo's desk, it rapidly became clear to Locke and Jean that Bilezzo was a fatuous, contrary, self-satisfied fellow who was deeply amused at the chance to have a bit of harmless mischief with his far-ranging civic powers. The two gentlemen bastards decided to correct his attitude in a traditional Camorri fashion. Locke doubled the amount of his proposed bribe, while Jean picked Bilezzo up by his lapels, scraped the ceiling with his head, and cheerfully offered to nail his tongue to the back of a carriage and whip the horses around the city. No middle-aged civil servant in a comfortable position could easily refuse such entreaties, and they parted with a mutually satisfactory arrangement. Bilezzo's men would continue, for appearance's sake, to carry out the pointless fumigation of Nikoros' building. Locke would conjure piles of gold to ensure it didn't happen there again, or anywhere else of value to the Deep Roots party, and Jean would spare Bilezzo the unwanted carriage ride. Nikoros came away from the meeting having learned several new words, as well as some novel hyphenations of familiar ones,
and a fascinating twist to the art of negotiation that his education had previously neglected. 5. Locke returned alone to Jostens just before the second hour of the afternoon, with the autumn air cool against his freshly shaved face, chewing on the last of the half-dozen sweet cakes he'd picked up for lunch. The place was in a fine state of near pandemonium, with locksmiths performing surgery on at least 3 visible doors, while the customary crowd of business folk bustled about eating, shouting, negotiating, or simply trying to maintain airs of importance. At the same time, the ordinary and legitimate business of the Deep Roots party went on. Locke and Jean had agreed that there was no need for them to oversee every last detail of the committee's business, lest they go mad while driving everyone around them mad into the bargain. Unusual events and setbacks, however, were very much their business, and Locke hadn't taken 5 steps past the front doors before a small pack of Nikoros messengers and assistants descended on him, waving scraps of paper. Locke flipped through them as he walked through the crowd and made his way up toward the party's private gallery. Constables had detained several important party supporters for public drunkenness. A district organizer had dumped his life savings into a bag and fled the city just before dawn, for reasons unknown. A candidate for the seat in Issas Vedrasta was going to fight a duel tomorrow, and there was no quality replacement if he ended up full of holes. Locke sighed. Casualty reports by all the gods, like some captain on a battlefield. Sabatha's hand could be in any of it, or none of it. No doubt the lists of complications would only get longer as the weeks wore on.
"Here's Master Lazari now," said Jean, as Locke ascended the final step to the private gallery.
Jean and Nikoros were standing before a group of 8 men. Most of them looked capable to Locke's eye, city bruisers, obvious ex-constables, and a few with the deep tans and weather-worn faces of caravan guards. They all nodded or muttered greetings.
"We've got a lead on some women, too," said Jean, whispering into Locke's ear. "Bodyguards! Nikoros found them. He'll bring them in tomorrow."
"Good," said Locke. He waved the slips of paper at Jean.
"Seen these?" "If those are the notes on today's pains in the arse, yes. You got anything to tell our new friends?"
"We want you content," said Locke, addressing the men. "We want you to feel that you're being treated fairly. If you're not, bring it to us. If anyone threatens you or makes you an offer, you know the sort of thing I'm talking about, bring it to us. Quietly. I guarantee we'll come up with a better deal." There was no point in mentioning consequences or making threats. Gods, no. Doing that in public was a sure sign of insecurity. Threats, when needed, would be a private affair. If these men had real quality, they would appreciate not being treated like idiots.
"Go find Jostin," said Jean. "Have yourself a bite. I'll have shift assignments once you've eaten."
As the men left the gallery, Jean turned to Locke.
"Where'd you go to get your shave? Back to Lachaine?"
"I didn't mean to be out so long. I, just thought I'd have my driver take me around some of the Black Iris places Nikoros listed for us, see if there was anything interesting going on."
"You were looking for her, weren't you?"
Yes. Didn't spot her on any street, though." Locke ran a hand over his chin for the 20th time. "How does it look?"
"What?"
"The shave."
"Like a shave. Fine."
"You're sure?"
"For Perelandro's sake. You got peach fuzz scraped off with a razor. You didn't commission a bust of yourself in marble."
Locke crumpled the notes he'd been handed and put them in a coat pocket. "Well, look, if you've got the new bruises in hand and you've already heard the news, I'm, going up to the room to get ready."
"You've got at least 4 hours before we have to leave."
"Yeah. But if I don't start my nervous pacing now, I'll never have it all done in time." 6. "How's it look?" Almost precisely 4 hours later, Locke was standing before a full-length mirror in their suite, showing off a slight variation in the tying of his black neckcloth.
"It looks like clothing," said Jean,
who had been dressed for the better part of an hour and was now lounging in a high-backed chair, ominously juggling a hatchet in one hand.
"Too prissy? Too eastern?"
"You do realize you've pushed that damn thing around at least a dozen times now?"
"Just doesn't seem right."
"You do realize that you didn't even own any of these outfits until yesterday?
Why are you fretting about the deeper meaning of clothes that are newer than some of the crap digesting in that meager gut of yours?
Because, said Locke, I can't help myself, and I know I can't help myself, and it doesn't help. You get it?
I do get it, said Jean softly, all too well. But I can't be of service by patting you on the back for being nervous. You've got to stick your chin out and call yourself ready sometime.
Nervous, said Locke. I wish I was nervous. Nervous is when armed people try to kill me. This is something else.
Gods, it's been 5 years. She could... I don't even...
He closed his eyes and leaned against the mirror's frame.
You might as well practice finishing your sentences, said Jean. I hear that women find it irresistible.
5 years, said Locke. He looked up, and the haunted expression in the mirror seemed like a self-accusation. I'm going to have to tell her about Carlo and Galdo.
She may already know.
I doubt it, said Locke. She was playing with us this morning. I just don't think that she would have done so. I wouldn't have in her place.
5 years apart, and you imagine that the two of you match moods so closely. Did you even do that when you were together?
Well, you and I are lucky to be alive to even see her, said Jean.
Remember that. As for what happened while she was gone, it was as much her decision to leave as it was ours to stay.
I know, said Locke, in my head. The message hasn't reached my gut just yet. There seems to be a tiny man in there attacking me with feathers. Now, jewelry. I should...
Gods above, said Jean, rising from his chair. Do you think she's going to fling herself out of a window if your shoes have too many buckles?
Her fashion sense might have grown more extreme since we last met.
Quit making such a yammering twit out of yourself. Find your way to the door.
Step by step out of the room, into the main hall, past the bar and the tables full of Nikoros people with their lists and plans and dull assignments. Guards, he was really on his way. His knees seemed to be made of wet cotton. His pulse was like the sound of the ocean in his ears. New solicitors watched from the Deep Roots gallery. New bruisers studied him from the front doors. New chains gleamed around the necks of all the waiters. So many cordons of security drawn tight against every possibility, and here he and Jean were planning a social call to the heart of Sabatha's power. Out loud, he would have been careful to say the opposition or his counterpart, but in the privacy of his own thoughts, there was no hiding from her. Nikoros met them and saw them to the door.
You are right about the guards and solicitors, he whispered. I do feel better.
Good, said Locke, ashamed at his own distraction.
Now that we have some security, said Jean, immediately taking the weight of confidence and authority that Locke had let slip, it's time we started reaching out and handing our friends some difficulties of their own. Think on it for us, would you? Weaknesses we can exploit, fast and easy ones.
My pleasure, said Nikoros. You know, 2 days in, this has already been more interesting than anything that happened last time. I'll wait up for you, shall I? I'd love to find out what sort of woman our, opposition is.
So would we, said Jean.
7. The carriage ride through the wet curtains of evening fog was no help for Locke's nerves, but as the minutes passed, he mastered himself well enough, he thought, to be able to handle simple sentences and walking. The Vel Vespala, the evening terrace, was one of Carthane's more fashionable quarters, its plazas dotted with taverns, chance houses, coffee bars, and bordellos. All of these places were so many blurry amber and aquamarine lights in the mist, as Locke and Jean's carriage pulled up before the sign of the Black Iris, the place Nikoros and his friends referred to as the Enemy Tavern.
Well then, said Locke, so here we... I'm not taking a quarter of an hour to get out of the carriage, said Jean. It's out the door on your feet or out the window on your head. Think fast.
Locke managed the former. The sign of the Black Iris was a comfortably appointed place, not as large as Justin's comprehensive, but perhaps slightly more luxurious, the wood panelling a touch richer, the marble of the exterior facings a trifle shinier. No doubt the rivalry between the two inns kept the pockets of many Karthani craftsfolk admirably lined. Locke's nervous distraction abated as his old street instincts kicked to life. The porter at the door was nothing special, but the two men at the rear of the darkened foyer were interesting. They were not at ease in their fine clothes, and what a coincidence that two lean fellows with such scars and crooked noses should be passing the time together. Muscle for sure. Sabitha, too, had set alley hounds to guard her lair.
Ah, sirs.
Another sort of creature entirely entered the foyer to greet them. This man was silver-haired, thin as a scabbard, with a drooping black flower pinned to the right lapel of his coat.
First son, Vardratha. I'm Mistress Galante's confidential secretary. You gentlemen do move at a relaxed pace. She's been expecting the two of you for some time now. Yes, some time indeed.
I would point out, said Jean, gesturing to a mechanical clock on the foyer wall, that it's not yet 7:05.
Of course. I made no reflection upon the accuracy of the clock,
The lines at the edges of Vordratha's mouth moved up a fraction of an inch. So he was that sort of fellow, supercilious and needling, unable to resist amusing himself with lame little digs. Locke's concentration came into even sharper focus as the urge rose to slam Vordratha's head against the door.
Come now, she wishes to see you directly, in private.
Locke and Jean followed him up to a hallway on the second floor. They brushed past a surprising number of men and women for a direct route to a private audience. Ah, but of course, they were all studying Locke and Jean while feigning indifference, stealing glimpses of faces and builds and manners in case the two of them ever attempted another visit without an invitation. It was flattering, really. At the end of the hall, Vordratha held a door open. The space beyond was dim, lit by the golden glow of small lamps on a number of tables. A private dining space with high windows looking out into the evening fog. A woman stood alone at the far end of the room, her long hair unbound, a cascade of dark copper falling to the middle of her back. She turned slowly, and before Locke knew what was happening, he and Jean were through the door. The door fell closed with a click, and Sabitha was coming toward them down the shadowed passage between the rows of lamplight. 8. She wore a velvet jacket the color of blood, a shade darker than her hair. Her outfit had the dash of a riding habit, narrowing to emphasize her slender waist, and beneath the long dark skirt she wore seasoned leather boots. A scarf, white as dove's feathers, was wrapped tightly around her neck. Other than a single lapel iris matching that of Vordratha, she had no ornaments but contrast, the harmony of skin, scarf, hair, and coat. She'd made an artist's palette of herself, emphasizing a beauty that had bloomed in the 5 years they'd been apart. Locke stepped out in front of Jean and removed his leather gloves with shaking hands. 5 years of dreaming and planning for this moment deserted him in an instant, leaving him with nothing but a half-wit's hypnotized stare and the air in his throat.
Hello, he said.
Hello, Locke.
Yes, Sabitha. Hello.
Meant to say something grander and wittier, didn't you?
Well,
the sound of her voice, her ordinary voice, unaffected, undisguised, unaccented, was like a glass of brandy gulped on an empty stomach.
Whatever it was, it seems to have business elsewhere.
It'll come back to you when you least expect it, she smiled. Write it down, then, and have it sent to me. I'll give it a favorable hearing.
They were just a few feet apart now, and in her face he could see time's peculiar alchemy. Every line was where it ought to be, but all the softness and reediness of the girl was gone. Her figure and features were fuller. Her eyes had changed, moving from a lively hazel to a truer, darker brown, a shade that was faintly reflected in her hair.
"Take my hands," she said,
and gently redirected his fingers when he tried to entwine them with hers. Palm against palm they stood while she returned his stare. Her touch was soft and dry. For a moment of pure anticipation, Locke thought she might pull him into an embrace, but she maintained the respectable distance between them.
"You're too goddamned thin," she said,
losing some of her dominating composure.
"I've been ill. They told me you were poisoned."
Who's they? You know, she said, and you've been out of the sun. Your Vadran is showing. We both seem to have gone back to our roots. Ah, the hair? No, the backs of your knees. Of course the hair. It's strange. I've been every shade of black, brown, and blonde these past few years, so I can disguise myself best now by going back to what's natural. Does it please you? You know it distracts the hell out of me. Locke felt himself blushing. Puts me at the most severe disadvantage. I know, she said, again allowing a touch of a smile. Perhaps I wanted us on familiar ground for the evening. She released his hands, gave a playful half-bow, and moved around him. Hello, Jean, she said. You've lost at the belly and gained at the shoulders, I think.
Hello, Sabitha.
He extended his left hand. You've gained a great deal and lost nothing, I can see. Dear heart. She met his hand with her own, and her eyebrows rose when he took her by the forearm and shook politely. What's this? 5 years apart and suddenly I'm just a business associate? Locke bit the inside of his lip as she put her arms around Jean and set her head against the lapels of his jacket. After the tiniest pause, Jean returned the embrace, his own arms easily folding around her and overlapping in the middle of her back.
I'll just need a moment to make sure everything's still in my pockets, he said as they parted. She laughed. What, you don't think I'm serious?
Jean examined his jacket carefully. He didn't bother grinning to lighten the moment. Ah, Sabitha said, stepping away from both of them and folding her hands in front of her. So how long did it take you to figure it out?
About a minute, said Locke.
Not bad.
A minute too long. The initials on that purse were cheeky as hell, but that get-up was excellent.
You liked it? Good. It wasn't easy, taking a few inches off my regular height.
One of the hardest things in false-facing, said Locke with a nod. You were showing off.
No more than you, before we were done. Still feigning illness in public.
It worked, said Locke, after a fashion. But you'd seen it before. Surely that's why you weren't caught too off guard.
That, she said, and you too should remember I can still read most of your hand signals.
Locke exchanged a glance with Jean. The fact that he hadn't been alone in neglecting this point was little comfort.
You get that one for free, she said.
So why'd you do it? Said Locke.
I wanted to see you both, she said, glancing away. I found that I was impatient, but I wasn't ready for this just yet.
We might have been a little late for this appointment if they'd thrown us in a hole, said Jean.
Tsk, she said, you're insulting us all, as if you couldn't have clever-dicked your way clear of those imbeciles before lunch. After all, your friend Justin still has his ardent spirits license. Clearly you two haven't forgotten how to stay on your toes.
That was cute, said Locke.
As was your riposte. It's a wonder to me how many people are so willing to believe the best of the laws that they live under.
They haven't had our advantages. Anyway, you shouldn't have sent a fat, good-natured fellow for that sort of work, said Locke. You should have arranged to put the warrant in the hands of some shriveled tent peg like your Vordratha.
Isn't he a treasure? Such a smirking, dry bitch of a man. He can't have spent more than a minute with you, and you'd crawl over broken glass to kick him in the precious bits, I'd wager.
Point me to the glass, muttered Jean.
Perhaps, once he's given me a good 6 weeks of work. She tossed her hair back and matched gazes with Jean. Jean, may I ask you to allow Locke and myself a few moments alone? I told Vordratha to have a chair set up just outside the door.
I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that.
Don't sit on it, then.
Jean's only response was to clear his throat.
May I beg to point out, said Sabitha, that the last reasonable chance you had to be cautious was when you stepped out of your carriage. I could have 20 armed people crouched in the next room. If I did, why would I bother to ask for privacy?
Well, said Jean with a sigh, I suppose I can feign civility with the best of them.
He was gone in a moment. The door clicked shut behind him, leaving Locke and Sabitha alone with 4 feet of darkened floor between them. Have I offended him? Said Sabitha.
No.
He seemed pleased to see me for a moment, and now he's sour.
Jean had... Jean met someone, and lost her in the worst way. So don't think it's just that he can't be terribly at ease concerning the matters that lie between me and you.
What matters could you be referring to?
Please don't do that.
Do what?
Invite me to name my troubles as though they were somehow unknown to you.
The device you're mistaking me for is called a mirror, Locke. I don't reflect your feelings as well as you seem to imagine, so I'm afraid you may have to name them for everyone's benefit.
5 years, Sabatha! 5 years!
I can count, and so what? I'm not leaping into your arms. I'm not tearing your clothes off under one of these tables. You may have noticed that I passed those 5 years without crawling back to Camor in search of you, nor did I find you exactly dogging my heels.
I meant to...
You meant, she said. There's a worthless coin, Locke. The past isn't something we can negotiate. I might not have come back for you, but you certainly didn't strike out after me.
There were difficulties.
Oh, she said. So you're the man whose life develops complications. I've so longed to meet you. The rest of us here in this world have it much too easy, I'm afraid.
Carlo and Galdo are dead, said Locke. Sabatha leaned back against the nearest table, folded her arms, and stared out the windows for some time.
I had my suspicions, she said at last.
When Jean and I came alone to Carthane?
I passed through Camor about a year ago, she said. I thought it best not to announce myself. It's like it was in the old days, before Barsavi. 30 coppers and no secret peace. I heard some confusing things. You'd been cast out by Barsavi's usurper, and no one had seen you since the mess.
The hammer came down on everyone, said Locke. Kappa Raza used us, then betrayed us. We were all meant to die, but they only got the Sansas. The Sansas and a younger friend. We had a new apprentice. You'd have liked him.
Well, she said, whoever he was, you certainly did him a grand turn as a garista, didn't you?
I'd have died, Sabatha. I'd have died if it would have saved them. I didn't have a fucking chance, and some help you were, whatever the hell you'd gone off to.
How could I stay? She said. How could I help you pretend to keep house? You wanted everything the same. Same glass burrows, same temple, same schemes. And now I learn that you even started taking apprentices. Boys, of course.
Of all the damned unfair...
Roots are for vegetables, Locke, not criminals. Chains had enough blind spots of his own, thank you very much. The last thing I ever could have done was prance along hand in hand to your pale imitation. I might have been able to live with you as a partner, she continued. As priest, garista, father figure? No. Not for an instant. Gods, that fucking pile of money Chains left us was the biggest curse he could have dreamed up if he'd spent his whole life planning it. I wish he'd thrown it into the sea. I wish we'd burned that temple ourselves.
We did burn it ourselves, said Locke, and I did throw the money in the sea.
What do you mean?
I had the whole mess of it sunk in Camor's old harbour, as Carlo and Galdo's death offering.
It's really all gone?
To the sharks and the gods, every last copper.
Thank you for that,
she whispered, and she reached out to set the back of her right hand against his cheek. He took a deep, shuddering breath, reached up and felt the heat surge in his blood when she didn't draw away from the pressure of his hand on hers.
For losing everything, he said. For the Sansas.
Ah.
You've grown some lines since I saw you last, she said.
It was a bad poisoning, said Locke, and it wasn't my first.
I can't imagine how anyone as charming and easy to get along with as yourself could ever incite someone to poison you. She said. I am sorry about Carlo and Galdo. I'm sorry I wasn't there to help, for what it's worth.
I suppose I'm sorry I was such a shitty garista, said Locke.
Maybe in a better life I could have stayed to watch these lines grow on you. Perhaps put them there myself, she said with a thin smile. But it's not as though I didn't arm you with the clearest possible expression of my feelings before I chose to go.
Frankly, sometimes I was surprised you stayed with us as long as you did.
I didn't nerve myself up to leave overnight. She lowered her hand and slipped it out of his grasp. When Chains died, you thought you had to preserve everything the way it had been, freeze our lives in amber. Maybe that was your way of mourning. It couldn't be mine.
Well, I, did trace you as far as Ashmere, Locke said. I never told anyone but Jean. I had someone up there that owed me a favor. After that...
Come here, she said, pulling out the nearest chair. Sit down. We're pacing like servants.
Is that the chair with the trapdoor beneath it?
Oh, don't be an ass. Choose anyone you like.
Locke pulled a chair away from a table on his side of the aisle and set it down next to the one Sabitha had offered. He gestured for her to go first, and when she was seated he eased into his, facing the door to the room. They were not quite facing one another, but turned inward at an angle with their knees almost touching.
I did what I'd planned, said Sabitha. I circulated in the Kingdom of the Marrows, started in Emberlane and moved west, hitting rich bachelors and the occasional married lord with a wandering eye.
Did they come up with a legendary name for you?
I'm sure they came up with a lot of names for me, she smirked. But once I was in the thick of things, I decided it was better to stay anonymous than to build a myth.
You know, I didn't start that Thorn of Camor bullshit.
Peace, Locke. It wasn't a rebuke.
So why'd you leave the Marrows? Get bored?
The Marrows are getting dangerous. Emberlane means to break from the rest of them. All the cantons are buckling on their swords. It seemed a good time to be elsewhere.
I've been hearing this for years, said Locke. Emberlane is always about to secede. The king is always about to fall over in his tracks. I even used this nonsense as the basis for a scheme. Hells, I fully expect the peace in the Marrows to outlive me.
Then you must be planning to die in the next month or two, she said. Trust someone who's been up there, Locke. The old king is airless and out of his wits. It's an open secret that he's ordered his Privy Council to choose his successor when he finally dies.
How does that guarantee a war?
It means that there are about 10 noble families that would get a vote, and 100 that wouldn't.
Do you think they won't prefer to just pull steel and get to work? They'll be hip-deep in corpses once they start really trading opinions. I see. So you were dodging that, and you got a job offer for a sojourn here in Carthane?
I was leaving Vintilla, she said. One moment I was alone in my carriage, the next I was having a conversation with a bondsmage.
I know what that's like.
Locke took a deep breath before asking the next question.
And they told you about Jean and me before you took the job? That you'd be set against us, I mean?
I was told.
Before?
Yes, before, and I agreed to do the job anyway. Do you want a moment to think very, very hard before proceeding on this point?
You're right. I have no cause to say anything.
We're not enemies, Locke. We're rivals. Surely we're both accustomed to the situation. And tell me, how would you have answered if our positions were reversed?
If I hadn't said yes, I'd be dead.
Well, if I hadn't said yes, I'd still be somewhere in the Marrows with Graf Kuldaros agents one step behind me. I have to confess I didn't manage to get out with as much money or anonymity as I might have hoped. In fact, I've understated the mess I left behind me. I'm sorry.
Jean and I weren't coming off one of our more lucrative exploits either.
So neither of us had any sensible reason to refuse this engagement.
Sabitha leaned forward.
The Magi offered to get me out, to erase my tracks, help me disappear in complete safety. That was their end of the bargain. And for my part, the chance to see you and Jean again was agreeable.
Agreeable?
No doubt you find it a mild term. But this conversation's too young to go back on our steps just yet. I've given you my facts. Now give me yours. Tell me what happened in Camor.
Ah, well. Locke found himself trying to scratch at the stubble that was no longer present on his chin. We had a scheme going, a good one, that would have added a fair sum to that pile of treasure you detested.
This was when the Grey King was abroad in the city?
Grey King, Kappa Raza, same man. Yes, we were chosen for the dubious honor of assisting the bastard in his war against the Barsavis. He had a bondsmage working for him.
My principals told me about him, said Sabitha.
The murdering shitstain was no credit to your principals, whatever they think. Anyhow, he must have spied us out along with the money in our vault. I've had a long time to think about the situation, and it's the only explanation that makes sense. We did our job, he continued, and then it turned out that the Grey King coveted our good fortune. He had a lot of bills to pay, so we got the chop. It was every fibre of his being, already unhinged by his more recent illness, revolted at the recollection of those moments drowning in a cask of warm, soupy filth. It was a near thing.
Did any of the Barsavis survive?
None. Nazca was murdered to put her father's nerves on edge. With our help, the Grey King tricked Barsavi into thinking he'd avenged her. He threw a party at the floating grave, and that's where he and his sons were taken apart. Hell of a spectacle. Remember the Barangia's sisters?
How could I forget?
They were in on it. Turns out they were actually the sisters of the Grey King. They served Barsavi all those years, waiting for the moment to strike.
Gods, what happened to them?
Jean happened.
And this Grey King?
Ah, Locke cleared his throat. He was my affair. We crossed swords.
Now to that I must admit some pleasant surprise, said Sabitha, and Locke felt a fresh warmth around his heart at the sparkle of interest in her eyes. Did you finally start paying attention to your blade work?
Ah, don't be misled. I'm afraid he opened me up like a physica. I had to trick him into letting me sheathe a dagger in his back.
Hmm, she said. I'm pleased you killed him. Still a pity you never amended your clumsiness with long steel.
Well, Sabitha, unlike some, I'm afraid I've just never had it in me to instantly presume a flawless expertise in every last sphere of human endeavour.
There was nothing instant about it. You might have thrown yourself into training as vigorously as I did, if you hadn't lived with the expectation of having Jean Tannen at your back for the rest of your life.
No, gods damn it, I would gladly listen to you berate me until the sun comes up, but not on this subject. Jean isn't some dog I tricked into a leash. He's my true and particular friend. He's still your true and particular friend, though both of you may need some time to recall it.
Forgive me, she said. I had your best interests at heart.
For someone whose primary insistence in life has always been that she must be taken true and unalloyed, unbending to the whims of those around her, you have a curious interest in the correction of my condition.
Ouch, she said softly.
Fuck! Locke slammed his fists down on his legs. Forgive me. I know you mean well.
No, you're right, she said. I'm an extraordinarily accomplished hypocrite. Anything that displeased you is unsaid. Please go on with your story.
Ah, all right. Well, not much more to say about Camor. We took ship for Velverazzo the night the Grey King died. Oh, I met the spider.
What? How did that happen?
When the Grey King business reached its conclusion, the Duke's people had no choice but to get involved. After an initial misunderstanding, the Spider and I worked together, very briefly.
Sweet gods, were you pardoned for your crimes?
Oh, hells no. Once the Grey King was dead, Jean and I bolted like rabbits.
And did you learn the actual identity of the Spider?
Yes, she and I had words on several occasions.
So it was a woman? As I'd always thought.
How did you know?
All those years of rumours, said Sabitha, and the one detail that emerged with absolute clarity from the fog was that the spider was a man. Everyone was certain. Now, if this person could maintain total control over every other shred of their identity, why was such a fundamental truth allowed to slip? It had to be misdirection.
Heh, so it was.
And who was she, then?
Ah, said Locke. I see I've got something that genuinely intrigues you. I think I'll hold on to it for a while.
Oh? I'll remember this, Master Lamora. On that you have my word. So you took ship. What next?
Warmed to the subject, Locke spent about 10 minutes summarizing the 2 years spent in and around Tal Verar, the nature of the scheme for Requin's Sinspire, the interference of Maxilan Stragos, the time in the Ghost Winds, the battles at sea, the loss of Ezri, the loss of nearly everything.
Incredible, Sabitha said when he drew his story to a close. I'd heard about the trouble in Tal Verar. You caused all that. You brought the god's damned Archon down. You silly, stupid, lucky little wretches.
As for our genius, we left Tal Verar without Jean's love, without a fortune, and without an antidote.
I'm sorry for all of that. Especially for Jean.
I'd say something comforting, like how he'll get over it in time, but I know he won't. Locke paused and lowered his voice.
I know I didn't.
Ah, said Sabitha. It was a completely non-committal noise.
And here we are, then.
Here we are, said Locke. Stories told.
I have instructions from my principals, she said. We're not forbidden from talking to one another, but in the matter of the election, look, we've got to fight it out to the last. Sincerely. All of our tricks, all of our skills, the consequences for holding back would be severe. So severe, I could never...
I understand, he said. I have similar directions from my, principals.
Gods, I wish we could talk all night.
Then why don't we?
Because I didn't expect to get this much honesty out of you.
She rose.
And if I don't do what I really brought you here for, I might lose my nerve.
Wait, what do you mean? She answered him by pulling him out of the chair and into her arms. Reflexively, he fought back for a moment, but the intensity of the embrace subdued him.
I am glad you're alive, she whispered. Please believe me. Whatever else happens, I'm so glad to see you.
I can't believe I have two reasons to be grateful to the Bonds Magi, said Locke. Gods, she was warm and strong, and her scent so instantly familiar beneath